We bring you this special radio television broadcast in order to give you the very latest information on an amazing phenomenon. Just a minute, ladies and gentlemen, I think something is happening.
Good evening. I hope you'll excuse me if I appear a trifle excited.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I want all of you to get up out of your chairs.
Whatever appears emerges as raw experience for those who watch it.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Sword Cinema Podcast. I am your temporary lead host, Patrick Murphy. This week, we're going to be looking at the films of Fantasia Film Festival, which has just concluded its 2017 run, month-long run. And joining me today is, of course, Ricky D.
What's up, Patrick? I've been waiting 4 weeks to do the show.
It's been four long weeks. You have seen a ton of movies, a ton. Another guy who has seen a ton of Fantasia movies is Goomba Stomp writer Thomas O'Connor.
Hi there.
Thomas, I think you and Rick definitely, like, you guys just plowed through Fantasia. I mean, I saw a few movies, but you guys just absolutely gouged it.
Yeah, I think I saw like low 20 something, maybe. Or maybe, no, not even. Somewhere in the teens.
Yeah, I saw well over 25 movies, but you know what? I'm kind of somewhat disappointed because back in the days, and I don't know how we did this, but Simon and I used to see like 45 movies a summer, which was insane. But this is because we were working at the video store, and so Fantasia at the time used to actually give us digital screeners, like on DVD screeners, so we could take the DVDs to work at Movie Land, and we would purposely work the graveyard shift, so we would watch the movies, let's say roughly around 1 p.m. at night, because not too many customers would walk in. So we would have the advantage of watching these movies while working. So we would still see movies on the big screen, but we would still try to watch some of the films that we weren't too excited about, but curious enough about to watch while working. So I don't know. It's not the same. I'm getting older. I work full time. You know, I'm not a student anymore. I've been going to Fantasia since the very first year, since I was in high school. So it means a lot to me. And I got to tell you, of the 21 years attending the Fantasia Film Festival, this is hands down one of the very best years. Like, I did not see one bad movie this year. There's one movie I did not like, but it's not a bad movie. I just did not like it. Tom, I think you saw it, and I think if I'm
we
not...
We both saw it.
Right. What, are you, whoa, which one are you thinking of? I'm thinking of Ghost Story.
Yeah, I'm thinking of Ghost Story.
Okay, you actually wrote a review of it. Yeah, so
yeah, I wasn't a huge fan of Ghost Story.
No, neither I. And I didn't really want to talk too much about it because I'm not a huge fan of the film, and I assume we're going to be doing a full review sometime within the next like 2 or 3 weeks when Simon catches it. But that's the only movie I saw that I did not like, but I still consider it a good movie. It just didn't really work for me.
That's what I've been hearing about Ghost Story. I'm curious to see that one. I have a feeling I'm kind of going to fall on the not like side, but I will try to keep an open mind on that one.
It's very divisive. You're either sort of on its like wavelength, or you're just like, no, I don't get this.
I'm going to get it and not be on its wavelength. How about that?
You walk in both worlds.
You know, you know what's so funny about that movie is the best scene in that movie, in my opinion, is a scene in which the main actress eats a pie for roughly 10 minutes. Like it's a static camera shot of her eating a pie. And that is the best scene in the movie. So if you think that that does not appeal to you, like your specific taste, do not see this movie because that's the best scene in the movie.
So that's either the best scene or the worst scene. I remember I read about that in Thomas's review. Yeah. And that had me wondering, could I take 10 minutes of watching her eat a pie? Yep. Mara Rooney. I don't know if I can do that. It's possible. It's possible. Anything can be accomplished in a good movie, but man, I have a feeling I'm going to, oh boy, that's going to be a good one.
Yep, for sure.
So I don't know if, Rick, you want to explain to anybody who doesn't know what Fantasia kind of is all about. There might be some people out there who haven't heard of what the Fantasia Film Festival is before you launch into your first pick.
Yeah, sure. So the Fantasia Film Festival started out as like this underground independent film festival. I think it was started by two, if not three people. And at the time, it was called Fantasia because they really only screened Asian films, like movies out of Hong Kong, mostly martial arts films. So like the first like year or two, it was a lot of like Jackie Chan movies, Jet Li movies. You know, like I remember seeing Drunken Master 2 on the big screen and the audience just like eating it up, like going apeshit crazy. And all of the Jet Li movies, I think, screened within like the first 2 or 3 years of Fantasia. And I think it was like in the second year, program director Mitch Davis introduced horror films. And they were screening a lot of Italian horror films like Mario Bava films, Dario Argento films, Lucio Fulci films. And from there, it just sort of expanded. And now they play documentaries. They play, you know, of course, they still play the martial arts films. They usually have a spotlight on a specific country. And it's honest to God, like the longest running film festival in the world, not just like genre film festival, but just like film festival in general. It usually lasts about 3.5 weeks. And within that time, they screen about anywhere from like 150 to 200 films. Usually, most of these movies have not yet screened anywhere in North America. A lot of them go on to become like huge cult fan favorites. Some have become like, you know, award-winning films. And they do still screen some big Hollywood blockbuster films. Like this year, they screened Luc Besson's Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. So that was like their big movie. And they also screened Atomic Blonde. But usually like the bulk of the lineup is movies you've never heard of. And that's what I love about the Fantasia Film Festival. It reminds me of like when I was a kid and I used to go rent movies at the video store. And I would just sort of like rent these like obscure horror films based on the DVD and or VHS covers. Because it just like had great artwork. And I had no idea who the filmmaker was. I had never heard of the movie. I would bring it home and it would just like blow my mind. Like a perfect example is Peter Jackson's Dead Alive. And that's what I love about Fantasia. Like, being that we live now in a time when you can find just about everything online, Fantasia still offers you that opportunity to discover these hidden gems, like things you would have never heard of had it not been for this film festival. And what I love about Fantasia, and maybe Tom, you can chime in here, is that I've been to a lot of film festivals. You know, I always compare it to like, say, TIFF. Like TIFF is like probably like the biggest film festival in North America in terms of like the amount of celebrities they get, the amount of movies they screen, and a lot of the movies they screen at TIFF end up being like nominated for like Best Picture at the Oscars. But TIFF is really all about the red carpets and the celebrities. I mean, people get press passes for the Toronto International Film Festival just to take photos of what the celebrities are wearing. It's not really always about the movies. Fantasia is all about the movies. And what I love about Fantasia, and I've talked about the festival, you know, for the past, like, whatever, like 9-10 years that we've been podcasting this like show, I've met like some of my favorite filmmakers, and not just met these filmmakers, but actually hung out with these guys for like hours at a bar, like John Carpenter, like George A. Romero, like Frank Henenlotter. And what's great about Fantasia is like everyone's on equal ground. I don't know. It's just like, I don't feel like I'm ever being judged. You know what I mean? Like when I'm at TIFF, like yeah. I could step into an elevator and I can kind of get the sense that people are just like frowning down on me or looking at me like strange. Like, what is this kid doing here? Why is he here at the press screening? Why is he in an elevator with Mariah Carey, who's like flipping out, which actually happened one time because she didn't want to get in the elevator because I was in the elevator. Do not understand that. Fantasia is not like that. It feels like a big family. It's amazing. I highly recommend, Patrick, you try your best to come down one day. You would have a blast at Fantasia.
Of all the ones that are around, I think Fantasia would be the most fun to go to because it is, like you said, it's people who love movies and that's what it's all about, as opposed to just sort of the festival experience that a Sundance yeah. or a TIFF might provide, where it's about more than just the movies. There's some politics involved in all of that.
Yeah, well, and the thing about Fantasia is that even if you watch a bad movie, you still tend to enjoy your experience watching the movie at the festival because of the way the crowd reacts to the movie. Like, people get really hyped. Like, people are not afraid to laugh out loud or make loud comments, especially if it's intended to be, like, a bad movie. You know what I mean? Like, one of the best screenings ever for me personally was watching Scott Pilgrim and Tucker and Dale back to back, and in between those two films was two killer, incredible, amazing, highly entertaining short films. And so it was like we sat in the theater for about 4.5 hours and saw four incredible films that just had the audience in stitches and raving and screaming and just like so enthusiastic and happy to be watching these movies on the big screen at the Fantasia Film Festival. It is hands down, in my opinion, the greatest film festival in the world.
Yeah, Fantasia audiences really are such a quintessential part of the experience. I mean, talking about just the meowing when the lights go down, which is something that so many people coming for the first time will just experience and be like, wait, what? And then within a year or two, they'll be like, oh, yep, I get it now. That's just one of the things Fantasia people do. Well, it's sort of the same effect as when you like get together with some friends and have some pizza, have some beer, watch something that's not really good, but you're having fun with it because of the environment. And Fantasia can definitely be like that, although there's also a lot of opportunity to see really, really mind-blowingly good films as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I know you guys both, I mean, I've read all of the reviews that have gone up, so I know you guys have both seen some fantastic, or, you know, what you're telling me are fantastic movies that hopefully we'll get to see at some point. We'll get a wider release. But Rick, do you want to go into what your first big movie is? I know you've been waiting to talk about this one.
All right, so the first movie I'm going to talk about, it's not the best movie I saw at Fantasia. It might not be my favorite film at Fantasia, but it's on the top three, and it's one of my favorite films of the year, period. The movie is called Plan B. I did not even want to see this movie. I only stuck around for this movie because I came out of Valerian and I saw my niece and her boyfriend standing in line to watch this movie. And so I just decided to stick around and hang out with them. And I had no idea if this was going to be a good movie end or not. Like, I saw the trailer. It looked intriguing, but I wasn't entirely sure if it's for me. This movie is amazing. Like, you know how we talk about how Atomic Blonde or Baby Driver are like some of the best action movies of 2017? I think Plan B is the best action movie of 2017. It's smart, it's entertaining, it's perfectly paced, it's full of jaw-dropping, fist-pumping fight scenes. But seriously, guys, like, this movie like has not one, not two, not three, but four incredibly charismatic leads. Like, each and every single one of these actors is just so brilliant. They share such great chemistry. They're so fun to watch on screen. They're so likable. I mean, most movies struggle to find one good actor, and I don't even know if these guys have acted in movies before. Like, if not, then it's just like, it's just amazing that they found these four guys for the movie. But the thing is, in real life, the four guys are actually best friends, and it comes across on screen. Like, again, the chemistry is just so unreal. Basically, it's like these three guys who are stuntmen, and they work for, like, it's not Hollywood Films because the movie's filmed in Germany, but they work for like these big budget films, but they're always just like stuntmen, and they want to actually be like actors. They want to be the lead in the movie. And so they're trying to land themselves a role in the next big budget German film, like action movie. And their friend, who's like the fourth member of the crew, sends them to an audition, but he gives them the wrong address. And so they end up at the wrong place, and they get sort of like involved in the kidnapping of the wife of the criminal boss. So they find themselves caught in the midst of a gangster war between two crime families of the Berlin mob. And after one of them is held hostage, the other three friends must follow orders from the gang in order to complete a mission that takes them across the city in search of the location that holds the deepest secrets of the feared gangster boss. So that's like roughly the plot of the movie. But what I love about this movie is it's like a tribute to the classic action films of the early 80s all the way up to the early 90s. There's like nods to movies like Red Heat, like Jean-Claude Van Damme movies, Steven Seagal movies, Big Trouble in Little China, Bruce Lee films. There's even an entire sequence that's a homage to Michael Jackson's Thriller. And that is actually my favorite part of the movie, because so there's the movie split into like six sections. There's the prologue, the epilogue, and then there is the four chapters. And the fourth chapter, it actually sort of like veers into like horror movie territory. And it reminds me a lot of like Hot Fuzz. Like, it involves this like strange cult that they run into at a cemetery, which is when the Michael Jackson homage kicks in, because one of the characters is dressed like Michael Jackson for... don't ask me why. You just got to see the movie. But there's a sequence in the movie, okay? We talk about great fight sequences. Like, there's no CGI work at play here. There's no rope work. You know what I mean? This is pure martial arts. And there's this scene in which the three guys go to a strip bar. One of them gets drunk. And while that guy is getting drunk, like, he's pissed drunk. So it's like, this movie's really, really funny, by the way. While he's, like, totally pissed drunk, the other two guys end up getting into, like, a fight with the... I guess she's like the owner of the strip club, but it's like this huge woman. Like, you know Brienne from Game of Thrones? Like, think of her, yeah. But like 7 feet taller and just like massive. Like this, and apparently the actress, she is like the top stunt woman for like Hollywood films. I do not know her name. I could not figure it out. I was trying to do a lot of research on the internet and hardly anyone's written about this movie. So they have this incredible fight sequence inside the strip club. And it's one of those like bar brawls that reminds you of movies like, what was that Patrick Swayze movie? Roadhouse?
Okay. Roadhouse.
Or, yep. Or, you know, like the fight in They Live? The back alley,
yeah. Yeah.
The knockdown, drag out brawl between Rowdy Roddy Piper and Keith David.
Right, like that back alley brawl. Think of a fight sequence like that, except involving amazing martial arts. Like, it's well choreographed, mm-hmm. And you have two guys fighting one woman. And what's so amazing about it is they actually lose. Like, these are like the protagonists of the movie. Like, these are two of the four main characters. And the writer-director actually decided that, no, they are going to lose this fight against this woman. Anyway, this movie is amazing. Honest to God, like, if you like a movie like Hot Fuzz, if you especially like martial arts action movies, this movie is for you. It is the most fun I've had at the movie theater all year. Like, I could not stop cheering while watching this movie. Like, I was so hyped when the movie finished that the director actually asked me if he can film my reaction because he wanted to send it to his actress in Hollywood. Like, I'm telling you, I was just like on a total high watching this movie. It's so incredibly funny. It has an amazing screenplay. Like, often when we watch action movies, we don't think of action movies as having great screenplays. The screenplay is so tight. And there's so many characters and there's so much going on, but it's just so smartly written. The dialogue is jam-packed with jokes, but each joke lands. This movie is amazing. Like, I wish to God you guys could see it so we can actually do a proper review. But I think this is, like, honest to God, the sharpest, most entertaining action comedy since Hot Fuzz. I highly recommend it if you can somehow find a way to watch it. It's called Plan B.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to be seeking it out.
Yeah, me too. I have to check that one out. I mean, that's something I think I could use as a nice palate cleanser to some of the more serious action movies that get put out. Thomas, what do you have? What do you have to follow that up with?
Okay, well, following it up with something you might not be able to see any of for a while. One of the things I saw that impressed me the most was a stop-motion film called Junkhead. And it's something that's clearly a passion project. It was orchestrated almost entirely by one guy, Takahide Hori, who wrote it, directed it, created the animatronic puppet, or not animatronic, stop motion rather, puppets, animated it, which if you know about stop motion takes ages, and he's been working on this for years and years and years, and releasing it in chunks. And you can actually see the first 30 minutes or so, the first piece he made, on YouTube right now in multiple languages. You just search Junkhead 1. And he's done more of it and expanded it into about a 2-hour film. And it's a really, really stunning piece of work that unfortunately grows frustrating when you notice the flaws in it, which are that it's a little too long, it doesn't quite have a proper ending. But to back up a little bit, it takes place far in the future, as so many of these movies do. Humanity has achieved immortality basically through transhumanism, so everyone is sort of a severed head ensconced in like a robot body. But there's this disease that's causing mass deaths. And years and years and years prior, a race of sort of clones or like bioengineered beings were created to fill the workforce because no more humans were being born. And eventually a war broke out between the humans and the clones were all driven underground. And they've created this strange sort of sub-society and this network of subterranean tunnels. So when this disease breaks out, the humans start sending people down to try and investigate the clones' genetic material and see if there's a cure there. That's the sort of basic setup. And the protagonist is one of these sort of explorers who goes down into the sort of tunnel system, I guess you could call it, to try and just see what's up. And on the way down, loses his memory, gets his normal body destroyed and gets placed in this sort of junky body. And from there, it's basically just a series of little miniature adventures as he sort of wanders around, meets all these strange characters. And just up front, the visuals of the film are stunning. They're so interesting and so unique and so polished and considered. If you're a geek for visual design and mechanical design like me, it's an absolute treasure trove of just visuals and aesthetics. Story-wise, it's really interesting, although I use the term story kind of loosely because it literally and figuratively wanders a lot. There's a lot of just sort of aimlessly wandering down gray corridors, which can get a little dull. But the thing that strikes me so much about this movie is that with a little more work, like an ending, maybe cut out some of the fat, this is, I think, easily one of the best animated films of the last few years. Like, it's on par with anything Lake has done, but maybe with a little bit more DIY charm and a little less sort of, I want to say polish, but sort of like, it has a more of a DIY feel, I think, is the sort of the crux of it.
This film is not complete yet, right?
I don't honestly know, because it's currently clocked in at like about 2 hours. And the way it ends, you feel like that isn't the ending. That's just where he's at right now. Like there's maybe another act or chunk of it that could still be made. I don't know if he considers it finished. He like tried to crowdfund more of it, or he tried to crowdfund some of it and couldn't raise enough money because obviously this is a hugely work intensive project. I really hope there's more of it, because I think if this gets finished and wrapped up nicely, it's like a staggering piece of work.
So I read your review and I was so incredibly jealous you saw the movie, because here's the thing, Patrick, about Fantasia is, like most film festivals, you can have 1, 2, 3 films screening at the exact same time. And so you stare at the program and you have to make the tough choice of deciding which movie you will watch. And sometimes you will make the wrong choice. But that's kind of what I like about the Fantasia Film Festival, because when you do make the right choice and you go see the right movie, you discover this hidden gem, it can be so incredibly rewarding. But when you do not make the right choice and all of your friends are raving about the movie that you decided not to see, it could be a real bummer.
Yeah, it's really a gamble picking what you want to see. But the good news this year is that for this one in particular, the first 30 minutes or so, the first chunk that the guy animated, I think about 2 or 3 years ago, is online on his YouTube account right now. And it's a really good indicator of what the film's about and what the style is like, what the music is like, everything. And this is really one of those projects that I want to draw more people to, because it's not being seen and talked about nearly as much as I think it deserves. So again, go on YouTube, type in Junkhead 1, should find it right away in the results. Check it out. If you're interested in seeing more, like, share it with your friends, because I really want to see this project get more attention, because if that happens, hopefully it can get, you know, the treatment and the attention it deserves.
I'm going to purposely not watch it now that you just made that little plea, Thomas. I was going to. You had me sold, but now I don't want. Now I'm going to run counterculture. No, I'll check it out. I read your review as well, and just some of the still images look absolutely fascinating. Like, this guy really has created a rich world.
Oh, 100%. He's got a really, really interesting aesthetic style that, I mean, for me in particular, just completely speaks to me.
All right, so I'm gonna go in the order that I saw the four movies that I picked for this. So the first thing that I saw was 7852, which had screenings at other film festivals. In fact, I believe Victor, one of our writers, had written a review of it already. But I'm a huge Hitchcock fan, and so I wanted to see this. It is basically a documentary about the shower scene in Psycho, which is, you know, one of the most famous horror movie scenes, thriller movie scenes of all time, and supposedly terrified people, you know, made them afraid of taking showers. And it's just one of the most interestingly cut sequences of all time, and one of the most influentially cut sequences of all time in movie history. So as a huge Hitchcock fan, I went into this just absolutely frothing at the mouth, hoping to sort of get some new insight into one of my favorite movies ever. And I came away like sort of 50-50 on this one. I think I'm not exactly sure who this movie is for. There's a lot of time spent gushing over Hitchcock, you know, the master, and, oh, he's so great, he's so great, he's so great. And if you're a Hitchcock fan like me, yeah, I know all that stuff already. Like, I don't need to hear people say it 1,000 times, and that's sort of what's happening.
They made an entire movie about one scene.
They did.
One scene.
So what they do, what they basically do is they sort of try to put Psycho in context of, you know, the time, Hitchcock's career, and they sort of give you a little bit of background on the movie in general as well, just so that newcomers aren't completely, you know, left out to sea or something like that. This is the part of the movie I think that I connected the least with, because this was kind of when they just sort of go over Hitchcock's whole, you know, career and his place in cinematic history and how everybody loved him, right? Like Cahiers du Cinéma or whatever, how they were just completely all about him and his interview with François Truffaut, which is all stuff that I've read. And if you're a Hitchcock fan, nothing will be new to you about this. But there's also a little bit of, did any of you guys see Room 237?
Yeah.
Okay, so you know how that was like one of the most hilarious movies ever made, right? I'm assuming you guys feel the same way as I do about that one. Like, that was an absolutely, that was like one of the greatest comedies of all time.
Well, I think that movie is incredibly entertaining, but it's not a good documentary.
No, it's a terrible documentary, but it's hilarious, right? Because these people are out of their minds. Well, there's a little bit of that in this. It is not to the extreme, but there are some people attributing things to Hitchcock and Psycho that are clearly just sort of crackpot. They're borderline crackpot theories. And that was the part of the film that I sort of, like I said, I connected with the least, because I really just wanted them to sort of dive right in. They have a lot of great guests, a lot of great people to interview, but so few of them actually offer any real insight, especially in that first half. But once they actually get into the shower scene and they talk to editors and sound guys and things like that, I really did learn some things. One of the most interesting segments had an editor, a working editor right now, breaking down all the mistakes in the shower scene. And I found that to be fascinating. Things where he didn't understand why cuts were made in a certain spot and how they would replay it over and over again so that you could see where the supposed errors were. And to listen to him try to figure out how this could have happened even back then. It's not that editing has become so much more sophisticated or anything. This is quite a sophisticated scene, as the editor points out. But sort of trying to figure out what Hitchcock's thought process was. And there are a few other errors that they relate sort of why things occurred the way that they did. There's a specific cut away from Janet Leigh's face, because when she's lying on the bathroom floor, because she took a breath. And there's this odd cut to the shower head. You know, it was supposed to all be one shot where they come. Okay, so there's the circling down the drain, as you guys know, right? Blood circling down the drain. And then that dissolves into Janet Leigh's eye. And the camera slowly pulls back, and it's her face, and she's still dead on the bathroom floor. And it was supposed to be one long shot pulling back from her face and then panning over to the bedroom and then over to the newspaper sitting on the bedside table where the money's inside. Well, they cut away to the shower head in that one, and it's because Janet Leigh had to take a breath, and so they really didn't have any choice. Stuff like that I found to be fascinating, and just sort of, and sound guys going over the different ways that they achieve, you know, how Hitchcock was so particular about what the stabbing noise, you know, with the actual sound of knife piercing flesh, you know, how he had brought in 40 different kinds of fruit and they stabbed each one of them multiple times in order to figure out what sort of made the best sound. There were lots of interesting things like that. I could have done without a lot of the gushing. Like I say, I find that stuff to be, it's just fluff, and I didn't want that. I wanted this to be a really hardcore psycho documentary. For people who aren't familiar with Hitchcock, I'm not sure that this will sell them on him, on how great he truly was. And for hardcore fans, there's only maybe about half the movie is actually worthwhile. But the half of the movie that's worthwhile is very worthwhile and very fascinating. And honestly, anytime that I can see more of Psycho or hear people talking about Psycho, I'm definitely going to take them up on that. So I did enjoy it ultimately. I just wish it was a little more hardcore.
Wow, maybe I should re-release our Hitchcock special. We had Bill Messe on that podcast and Justine Smith, and it was one of our best shows. We reviewed Psycho and the Birds.
Ooh, two ones that are loaded with subtext.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, it's, I mean, Hitchcock, I could go on forever about him. I'm currently reading a book on Vertigo at the moment. And I've got another one on Rear Window to make. Hitchcock has made several of, I would say, my top 20 movies. Hitchcock has made probably four or five of them, top 20 favorite movies. So I'm a huge fan of the guy. If I ever end up making a movie, I will try my best to imitate him as much as Brian De Palma did. So I think that'll wrap up our first round of movies. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with four more.
The use of the sound effects that are, I think, a huge contributor to the violence of the scene. The stabbing sounds in particular.
How do you come up with the sound of what happens when a butcher knife strikes flesh? The sound man came up with the idea of, what about a knife stabbing melons? So, knowing Hitchcock, you would have to bring lots of melons and arrange them on a big table. There'd be Crenshaw melons and all, you know, any kind of melon that you can imagine of very, very different sizes. So I think they had about two dozen and some backups. So there's the prop man stabbing melon, 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 next melon, melon, melon. And so by the end of it, Hitchcock knew the one that sounded most like sinew and sounded the way he thought it should sound. So when they were through demonstrating all of these different melons, all he said was, cassava. That's all they needed to know.
I think the whole key to the sound of the cassava melon is that the inner gooey part is very small and there's a very thick layer of fruit that you have to stab through.
It's very dense. It's dense. Not hollow. Like a lot of the other melons sounded a little bit hollow. And I'm sure with his eyes closed, Hitchcock was probably hearing that.
To my ear, cassava melon sounds more like dry, bony stabbing as opposed to wet, gooey stabbing.
The starchiness and the thickness probably gives you more of that viscera, the crunchiness.
Viscera.
Viscera.
Hitchcock also had them bring a sirloin, a really big thing of sirloin. I don't eat meat, and so I'm nearly nauseous telling you this, but in any case, Hitchcock thought that would be a really great idea. And they did, in fact, stab a big, big, big slab of steak. And so that sound is interspersed with melon.
Okay, we're back, and we're going to continue where we left off, talking more Fantasia movies. Rick, what is your next pick?
Okay, so my next pick is this Italian film called Da Laplace's Demon, which pretty much unfolds like an episode of The Twilight Zone, only like maybe like one of the greatest episodes of The Twilight Zone that you've never actually seen, because the movie is fantastic. It's one of the best films I saw at Fantasia. So, of course, it's based on the scientific theory of the same name, and the film follows seven researchers who are working on a system to predict the future. So, to test their version of the mathematical theory, The team focuses on predicting how many pieces of glass there will be when a glass is broken. So they think they've broken new grounds, and when they believe they've done the impossible, they are awarded an invitation to visit this famous professor who lives on a remote island in the middle of nowhere in like in this huge mansion. Picture this film, like again, think The Twilight Zone, you know, black and white, it's in Italian, and the group arrives on this mysterious island in the middle of nowhere, and they have to enter this like huge mansion. And as soon as they step into the mansion, they get locked in. And instead of meeting the professor, when they arrive, they're greeted with this this videotape recording, and the videotape recording has a message, like basically the professor filmed himself. And so the silhouette on the television explains the rules of the game. And so they realize that they're trapped in this deadly game. And they're actually trapped. It's so hard to explain. They're actually trapped in a real-life version of the game of chess. And they are the pawns. And so they actually have like these big set pieces, like, you know, the king and the queen, and that are chasing them throughout the mansion and trying to kill them. I know it sounds weird.
Sorry, this sounds awesome to me. I'm sorry. Okay. I like after reading your review this morning, yeah. I so want to see this.
So they find themselves pawns in a death trap programmed with a revolutionary equation that anticipates their every move. And so they need to work as a team in order to hopefully survive the night. But based on this theory and thanks to science, they most likely won't survive. So that's what the movie's about. It's so bizarre. And like, I wrote this in my review, like on paper, if you pitch me or if I read a script that describes this movie with seven people running away from giant chess pieces that are trying to kill them, I'm like, you are on crack. This sounds like the stupidest idea. But it actually totally works. Like, it adds this unique charm to the movie. But seriously, this film just looks beautiful. Like, the way it's framed, like the compositions, the way he frames them in each shot, like the way they stand in the foreground, the background, the middle ground, like it's just a beautiful, beautiful looking film. Like, the cinematography is dazzling, and I love the use of old school filmmaking tricks. For example, rear projection, creative low-key lighting, there's a lot of like Dutch angles, practical effects, there's no CGI, at least not that I'm aware of. And there's this like really cool thing that he uses a lot of beautiful miniatures, like for the actual chess pieces, but he also uses this like clockwork machine. It's hard to describe, but there's just like the whole entire film is just like, it's beautiful. It took like 7.5 years to make this movie, and it's well worth the wait. Like, this is, I think, like probably the second best film I saw at the Fantasia Film Festival. It's not my favorite, but I think it might have the best screenplay. And I think that's why you would love it, Patrick, just because of the script. Because I can talk about how great the cinematography is and how great the actors are, but the script is the best thing about this movie. So it's called The Laplace's Demon, and it's just this interesting black and white, low budget film that finds interesting and clever ways to explore the patterns of human behavior. I highly recommend it, even if it sounds strange. Check out the trailer. Check out my review over at GoombaStomp.com.
I think it sounds incredible. I want to see that one probably more than anything else. I'm such a huge fan of The Twilight Zone, not only the way they constructed their stories, but the way they look. And if this movie has kind of that same, I love hearing stuff like Dutch angles, black and white, you know, if they're using dolly shots, rear projection and miniatures, things like that, I want to see this for sure. I love that style of filmmaking. So Thomas, what do you got for us next?
Well, the next thing I saw that really stood out for me was a Korean movie called Confidential Assignment. And it has a somewhat timely premise. if you've been paying attention to the news, you know, tensions are a little high right now on the Korean Peninsula. So what better time to present a buddy cop movie where the buddy cop duo in question, the comedically mismatched pair, are a detective from South Korea and a detective from North Korea.
this one, I think, best film, if not best action movie at Fantasia.
Did it win one of the audience awards? I didn't hear that.
It won one of the biggest awards, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, definitely deserving. It's the setup is fairly straightforward. North Korea basically has a high-ranking general defect and take a bunch of counterfeiting plates with him. Obviously, the government doesn't want the rest of the world to know that this was a thing that happened. The general, of course, goes directly to Seoul to try and sell the plates and, you know, escape to the rest of the world. So a North Korean soldier cop type is paired up with a South Korean cop to try and solve it. And it's very much a classic buddy movie. Like, you've got, you know, the classic sort of mismatched pairing with all the stereotypes you could imagine. The North Korean guy is very stiff and action-oriented and unyielding and doesn't have a sense of humor at all. The South Korean cop is, you know, kind of doughy and clumsy, and he's the comedic foil. And, you know, it's your classic straight man, funny man pairing. And you'd think that would be kind of dull, but the movie does it so well that it doesn't really matter that you've seen this a million times before. And that's kind of this whole movie in a nutshell. It's playing to so many familiar tropes and formulas, but it's playing them all really, really well. And it's one of those films that knows exactly what it wants to be and just accomplishes that. It's not trying to, you know, push the envelope or break the mold or anything like that. It's just going, okay, remember buddy cop movies? Let's just be one of those with one new wrinkle, which is the North-South Korean thing. But beyond that, just make it a fun buddy action cop movie. And that's exactly what this is. And it's tricky because it means there's not a whole lot to say about it. The action is good. The music is actually really good. The two leads are both really charismatic at doing very opposite things. It's just one of those movies that you go and see and have a really fun time with.
You know, it's interesting because I never actually agree with the films that win awards at the Fantasia Film Festival. Like, each and every single year, I feel like they're good movies, but they're just never the best films I've watched. Yeah. I think Plan B is the best action film of the year. And I think the problem is not enough people saw Plan B, including members of the jury. But yeah, Everybody flocked to go see Confidential Assignment. And it's a shame. Like, I mean, not to say that the movie isn't good and doesn't deserve awards, but Plan B is really the movie to see. I mean, I even saw Jailbreak, which a lot of people are comparing to The Raid, you know, except it comes out of Cambodia. The whole entire film is just one giant fight sequence. But unlike The Raid, which goes from the bottom floor to the very top floor of a skyrise building, this takes place in a prison, and they have to get from one end of the prison to the other end of the prison. So they go from one cell block to the next cell block. And it's one massive, massive fight sequence, which I think there's like maybe like hundreds of extras. And it's mind-blowing the way they shot, especially given the fact that it's a low budget film. But that's the beauty about the Fantasia Film Festival. Like, we are only going to talk about a few of the many great movies that screened this year. So yeah,
it's really the tip of the iceberg, like whatever we can really talk about in the span of one podcast.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I was telling Thomas, I thought about talking about Town on the Lake in this one, which was basically a CSI procedural, CSI Philippines, you know, murder, kidnapping, rape case, whatever, very low key, that ends involved with aliens in the last 2 minutes. Like, I could probably talk on about something like that for a little while. There's a lot of weird stuff I'm sure that plays at this festival that I did not see. That was certainly one of them. But instead, I'm going to go with movies that I actually enjoyed a lot more. And I would say that my second favorite movie that I saw was something called Sequence Break, which was kind of a horror movie along the lines of a David Cronenberg style body horror thing.
When I read your review, I was tripping out. Like, oh my God, I need to see this movie. You need to explain to our audience why everyone needs to see this movie if they can.
Well, I mean, it's got a fairly interesting concept, which is that there's this guy who repairs old arcade machines. It's a young man, kind of awkwardish, maybe not antisocial, but socially awkward, sort of nerdy, but in a realistic way. He repairs arcade machines for this older man who then goes out and resells them. And that business is closing down, and, you know, everybody's a little sad about that. But on the last day, they get this mysterious delivery of a motherboard that fits this cabinet to this weird game. And this game seems to be always on as soon as the motherboard is installed. It, like, an eye is watching them. And at the same time that mysterious events are going on surrounding this cabinet, which has got a strangely hypnotic game to play, the main character meets a young woman who, you know, is interested in him. They meet in one of those Hollywood situations that would never happen in reality. But thankfully, the rest of the relationship is actually very, very charming and very natural and realistic. And I really dug the chemistry between the two actors and their romance. So going on concurrently is this romance with this guy. But then at night, he goes back to his arcade shop and he gets engrossed in this game. And this is where the David Cronenberg stuff comes in, because there's some icky stuff going on in this movie.
Some icky
stuff. Let's just say that, like, he essentially has sex with this arcade machine, this cabinet. It's really gooey, and it's like, I don't know how to describe it, but it's not quite as cringeworthy as a lot of Cronenberg stuff can be, because Cronenberg gives me like a feeling in the pit of my stomach sometimes that I just don't, even though I'm fascinated by what's happening in his movies, like, it just leaves me feeling a little bit ill. This one had me just sort of chuckling a little bit because of how uncomfortable it made me. Especially the sex scene with the arcade cabinet, which I'm calling it that. It's not like a literal sex scene, but it kind of is. Yeah. It's very hard to explain. Anyway.
Sounds amazing.
What's that?
It sounds amazing, like, in all honesty. I mean, you won me over with the words arcade machine and David Cronenberg in horror film.
Yeah.
It's basically like it's a movie that's trying to deal with choice. I'm not going to say that it blends, you know, how choices we make in our life, you know, can have impact on us. I'm not going to say that it blends the romance with sort of the horror aspects perfectly. There's a little bit of vagueness there, but I was never not entertained by this, no matter which side of the story he was doing. So whether he was doing kind of the nice, sweet relationship that was going on, which felt absolutely great, and like I say again, the chemistry between these two actors is really fantastic, or when he was doing the dark, weird, trippy, inside the cabinet, you know, arcade cabinet kind of stuff, where wires are growing out of a guy's face and the machine is trying to take him. It had like, okay, so Rick, you're going to love this reference as well, but I think I said this in my review too, but it's got elements of Christine as well. Like, this arcade cabinet is jealous of his relationship, right? And it's trying to possess him in a way, which is where these sort of sex scenes happen. Anyway, it has a lot of weird elements, and it works really well, I think, as just sort of a Cronenberg light. Is how I would describe it. But it's kind of fascinating. It's very low budget, though, so I got to give the director all the credit in the world on this. Graham Skipper is his name. So he did a really good job kind of figuring out how to make things interesting in essentially one location and with very few actors. But it comes across visually. He does a great job setting up the camera. He knows where to put the camera to make the confined space just seem more interesting, have more variety aesthetically. And he knows how to inject colors and really weird imagery into it sometimes. And the practical effects guys are fantastic. Like, I bought it 100%. Like, they really did a top-notch job with the sort of gooey, icky, sticky stuff in this movie.
Okay, I know we got to take a break, but I'm going to cheat. I got to squeeze in one more movie, guys, because I saw two absolutely incredible films, guaranteed to be on my top 10, guaranteed to be on most people's top 10. I'm going to talk about one of them right now. It's called Super Dark Times. Has anybody seen this movie?
No.
I didn't get to that one, no.
Holy, this was like the biggest surprise, not just for me, but for everyone. It was the movie that everybody was talking about. Each and every single time I was standing in line, everyone was saying, have you seen Super Dark Times? It was like the surprise hit. So it comes from the director, Kevin Phillips, who actually had a film screened at the Cannes Film Festival back in 2015. It was a short film called Too Cool for School. That short film had critics raving. This is his first feature-length film. And I got to tell you, it is like one of the best teen dark dramas I've ever seen. Like, this movie is destined to find a cult following. In 10 years' time, I suspect people will look back at 2017 and remember fondly of Super Dark Times, and most likely listed as one of their favorite, if not their favorite, films of 2017. Like, this is going to be like the Donnie Darko for a new generation. So it's, you know, it's like this coming of age slash horror film. It takes place in the mid-1990s in, I think, upstate New York. And it follows two teenage best friends named Josh and Zach. And it's one of those movies where at the start of the film, there's the combination of stolen marijuana and a samurai sword leads to the fatal
and accident- go together.
Right. Leads to the fatal and accidental killing of one of their best friends. And so, of course, the boys try to cover up the murder. And in doing so, things spiral out of control. Now, that's the setup for the film, which you might think, you know, we've seen that kind of film done a million times before. But this film, it feels so authentic. Like, the way the kids speak, the way they interact, like, I feel like as if they weren't even given a screenplay. It was sort of like they just improvised each and every single scene. It's one of those films that also feels timeless. And I think by setting the movie in the mid-90s, prior to internet, prior to social media, prior to Columbine, it makes the film just, I don't know, just stand out more. Like, so it's like, have you ever seen The River's Edge?
Yes.
Okay. The best comparison would actually be The River's Edge. This is, you know, it dances a fine line between coming of age drama and indie horror, using the subject of murder to dig deep into teenage psyche. Like, what we have here is basically a fascinating, incredibly entertaining, albeit downbeat study of friendship, guilt, suspicion, innocence, friendship, loyalty. It's a kind of like film Hitchcock would make if he was alive today and maybe 16 years old. Seriously.
That's the line that got me interested in this one for sure.
Yeah, no, it's so good, dude. Like, you gotta see this movie. And it's one of those movies, like, you know, when you watch these movies that are set like in the 80s or like the 90s or even like a TV show like Stranger Things,
yeah,
like it jams everything in your face, like all these pop culture references. Not this movie. Like, you do get Bill Clinton on the television set doing some sort of speech at one point, which is how I clued into the fact that it actually takes place in the 90s. And yeah, they don't have cell phones, but they have cordless phones. You know, little touches, like little period details, but it doesn't overdo it. And the acting is top notch. It's perfectly cast. Beautiful cinematography. Incredible script. The only thing is, I feel like some people might have a problem with the last 5 minutes because it veers straight into like slasher film horror territory. But put aside the last 5 minutes, which I personally like love, I think this is like, honest to God, one of the best films of 2017. It's going to guarantee, I guarantee you, it's going to be on a lot of people's top 10 list. And it comes out, and here's the bummer. I don't think it's getting theatrically released, but it does come out on VOD at the end of September.
Oh, that's good, at least.
Yeah.
I mean, that's something. That's better than nothing. At least people can watch it. That's always the problem with a lot of these films is how can you go about seeing so many of them? But, you know, the more that at least get released on some format, God, the better.
Yeah, it's so good. It's so good. And, like, I'm such a visual person. Like, it's shot on digital, but they use these 35mm lenses, and it actually looks like film, and it's beautiful. And as beautiful as it is, it's also incredibly bleak. And it's got this beautiful, well-modulated score, this high-powered soundtrack. It just generates an incredible amount of tension and urgency in almost every single scene. It's fantastic. Love it. You got to see it. Super Dark Times. Trust me.
All right. Well, when we come back, we're going to each reveal our three favorite. Each of you are our favorite films of the Fantasia Film Festival from 2017. We'll be back in a little bit.
Guys, my parents rented that movie True Lies.
Don't do it.
I've watched that scene where she strips over and over and over.
Silver Surfer is the loneliest dude in the galaxy.
I mean, the Punisher is pretty haunted.
Yeah, you have no idea what you're talking about.
Allison Bannister.
Hi.
Would you?
I don't know. I like her.
Yeah, I like her too.
He's got a thing for me. I like you, Zach.
She's hot, like Charlie's sister.
Shut up.
Oh my God. Yeah! Let me see that.
Give it back.
You want it? Come and get it.
Stop!
What did you do?
Do you remember Daryl Harper? Got a call from his mom. Guess he never came home last night. Did you see him at school today? Are you okay?
There's just a lot going on right now.
Josh?
We should go back.
What?
I don't know, but I just keep thinking of his mom.
Don't go back there.
You need to listen to
me. No, you need to listen to yourself.
You're scared all the time.
Stay away from politics.
If anyone asks, we're not friends.
I'm not getting any sleep. I know how you feel.
No, you don't know how I feel!
What's happening? We're friends.
We're back, and everybody's going to reveal what they what their favorite movie from the 2017 Fantasia International Film Festival was. Rick, you have had, it sounds like, a ton of movies. I'm going to be interested in hearing which one beat out the other three that you really liked so far, but what do you got for us?
Oh boy, oh boy. This movie is special. This movie is called Low Life. I'm sure you've heard of it. People have been raving about it. It's directed by a gentleman named Ryan Prowse, who I've never heard of. What's great about this movie, so I don't know if you know how Fantasia works, Patrick, but usually the programmers at Fantasia, of which I think there are about six, they have like a ton of films on their radar. Like, each have a list of movies that they hunt down each and every single year that they try to program into the film festival. Every so often, they get this mysterious package delivered to them, and they watch a movie sent to them, like on DVD or Blu-ray, and it just blows their mind. It's very, very rare, but this is one of those movies that came out of nowhere. No one had ever seen it. No one had ever written about it. Nobody even knew this movie existed. It's fucking amazing, guys.
That's really weird that that can happen. Yeah. I mean, it's great that it can, too. I love that they'll still accept something like that.
Mitch Davis, the program director, says he gets about 1,000+ he gets about 1,000+ submissions in the mail, like, per year. He watches as many as he can. He says about 90% of them are not very good. Sure. 10% of them are okay, but still not good enough to make it into the film festival. This movie was not only incredible, but it was the movie he was most excited to show everyone this year. Now, the thing about this movie is, I'm gonna let you guys know this right away, there's a lot of comparisons being made to Pulp Fiction, and I understand why, because it's one of those movies where it follows around a group of people, mostly criminals, and it has its title cards, and the movie shot in a non-linear fashion. So you follow one group of people in scene one, and then you completely flip to the next group of people in chapter two, which doesn't really relate to the first chapter. And of course, at the very end of the movie, in like chapter four, you realize how all of these stories interconnect, right? Now, put aside the structure, which, by the way, I think this movie is beautifully structured, it really doesn't have much else in common with Pulp Fiction. Like, I actually think in many ways this movie is way better than Pulp Fiction. Holy shit, this movie is so good. And I think the reason why I like this movie so much is because it has so much heart. Like, it's like, despite the fact that we follow around these criminals and these lowlifes and these really deep, darkly depressing subject matters, like, it just has so much heart, like, so much emotion. Like, you can tell that the screenplay writers, of which there are five screenplay writers,
and it ended up being good.
And yet somehow they managed to write an incredible script. They actually care about each and every single one of these characters. I don't even want to tell you what the movie's actually about because we're short on time and I will be here forever. But to sum it up, there's one character whose name is El Monstro, I think his name is. I think it's pronounced El Monstro. Mm-hmm. And
the monster.
It's like, you know, you ever watch like wrestling? And you know, like in Mexico, the most famous wrestlers, they always wear those like
luchador
right?
masks.
They always wear those masks, right? So his dad was a famous wrestler, so he wears this mask, but he doesn't want to actually take off the mask because he actually believes he is this character. Like, it's really bizarre. And he has a wife named Kaylee, and she's pregnant, and she's also a heroin addict. And then there's like this criminal, like this low life, who's like a criminal boss, basically. He runs like a taco shop, but under the taco shop, he's also running like this underground illegal like prostitute ring where he kidnaps these illegal immigrants and forces them into prostitution. And then there's like this hotel, and all the characters actually interconnect and cross at the hotel. So the hotel's like the central like location of the whole entire film. And at the hotel, the lady who works at the hotel, like who actually owns the hotel, her husband is dying, and so she needs to find them a kidney because he's got a failing organ. And so she hires this criminal boss to get him a kidney, only the kidney is supposed to come from the pregnant wife, the wife of the guy who is a masked Avenger, El Monstro, like the famous Mexican wrestler. And then there's the two thugs, one of which just was released from prison. He's this white guy, and while he was in prison, he had to like take a side. So even though he's like this big like hip hopper and loves like, you know, he loves like African Americans, when he was in prison, he had to side with the neo-Nazis. So he comes out of prison, he's got this big swastika like tattooed on his face, like on his entire face. And he has to hang out with his best friend, who's of course African American. And it's so awkward and odd, but yet so incredibly funny to watch the two of them interact. And so they get involved in this big crime spree because they have to kidnap the pregnant wife, the wife of the Mexican wrestler. it's complicated. And like the way the movie opens up, like it opens up and you, like right away you think it's going to be like a straight up like torture you think it's going to be like a torture porn film, like something like Saw or Hostel, because it's really bloody and graphic and disgusting and intense. And then it swerves into something that's more on the lines of like Pulp Fiction or Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. But it goes everywhere. But the thing about this movie is, honest to God, it is so incredibly funny. And I think, like, the way I would best describe this movie, and I haven't yet seen anyone describe it this way, because everyone's bringing up the references or the comparisons to Pulp Fiction. I think this movie has a lot in common with Breaking Bad and also Preacher, like the Preacher comic book. And I think that's the best way to describe it. Think Preacher, the comic book, and think Breaking Bad. That's what this movie reminds me of. Like, I honestly got to think that this movie could have been a hit TV show, like on AMC or something. Yeah. So, yeah, it's really hard to talk about. But just to close it off, despite the fact that this movie is really fun at times and really gross and horrific and disgusting and bloody, it also has a lot to say. Because it's really like a look at modern America, specifically under the Trump era. And it's just really depressing view of the United States and what's going on with illegal immigrants and drug addiction. And it has a lot to say, you know, politically, Like right away at the beginning of the movie, there's an ICE officer who kidnaps the illegal immigrants and forces them into prostitution. So it and it's one of those movies that's at times, like, it's honest to God heartbreaking, but yet at times it's really difficult to watch because it's like, you know, it's disgusting. Like there's a lot of terrible things that happen in this movie, and yet it's the funniest movie I saw at Fantasia. Like, you know, when we think of 1996, people think of Pulp Fiction, you know? When people in 10 years from now will think of 2017, they will think of a movie like Low Life. I guarantee you.
I've heard good things about it, but yeah, I'm looking forward to that one. I'm certainly up for that one, just having seen the trailer, so.
This movie does more in 96 minutes than what Pulp Fiction did in 2.5 hours.
Was Pulp Fiction 2.5 hours?
I think so. Pulp Fiction's a long movie, man.
Yeah, it is a long movie. I actually was never, we don't need to get into this as an aside, but I was not like a worshiper of Pulp Fiction, even when it came, especially when it came out, and I'm still not completely. But if this one's better, then I'm all for it.
Yeah.
All right. Sure. So, Thomas, what do you got? What do you got to top that?
Well, okay. If I had to pick a favorite thing I saw this year, what I think is the best film, it's actually the first thing I watched. It's the newest film by who I think is one of the most exciting directors working in martial arts films today, who's a guy named Xu Haofeng, who started out as a novelist and wrote a number of martial arts novels that were adapted into movies, and is actually a practitioner himself. And he started directing in, I believe, 2012 with a film called The Sword Identity. And I remember seeing that with two friends of mine, one of whom is a professor at Concordia, the other of whom did his master's degree in martial arts films. And they came out of that just sort of awestruck, just sort of like, wow, that was something new. Like, I haven't seen that before. That's a new voice. And since then, he's done another film called Judge Archer, and then this one this year, called The Final Master. And to briefly describe the plot, because it has a very labyrinthine plot, which is something I'll get into. It's set in China in, I believe, the early 1900s, late 1800s. And the main character is the last practitioner of a martial art called Wing Chun, which has a whole lot of history behind it and is still around today. And he wants to open up a martial arts school. But in order to do that, he has to sort of jump through all these societal hoops and establish himself in the area. And it sort of becomes the story of him training this day laborer in Wing Chun to challenge the local masters and, you know, earn the right to open up his school. And the director has a really, really unique style, both in terms of storytelling and cinematography. Because he's a practitioner, he has a real respect for martial artists and, you know, the people who can do this stuff. So the thing you notice most about his style is that he really pulls things back in terms of editing and cinematography and just lets the performers take the forefront. It isn't one of those movies where a lot of stuff is obscured by shaky camera work and, you know, really fast editing. It's a lot of sort of one take and a lot of, you know, static camera angles, which I can understand some people might find less exciting. But for someone like me who's been watching martial arts movies for a long time and is getting, you know, sick and tired of just incomprehensible fight scenes, his work is some of the best stuff out there because you can see what's going on. And plot-wise, it's almost the opposite, because he, again, comes from this place as a novelist and a huge enthusiast of martial arts movies and fiction. And his stories tend to be these really, really complicated webs of sort of, you know, plots within plots and betrayal and subterfuge and all this stuff. So it's really easy to get lost. It's so, so easy to, like, you know, sort of look away for one scene and you come back and it's like, wait, what's going on? That guy switched sides. That other guy switched sides again. So his films are on a very specific wavelength that I can totally, totally understand someone not being into. I can totally, get someone finding this film maybe even dull or confusing or just lacking in something. But if you're on that right wavelength and you can appreciate what he's trying to do, this is easily one of the most exciting martial arts movies, I think, of the last few years. Yeah, Xu Haofeng is a really, really interesting new voice, and he's being given a lot of projects. He wrote The Grandmaster, which came out a couple of years ago, the Wong Kar-wai film. Also really good, but watching this, you really start wishing, oh man, I wish he'd directed that one instead of just writing it. And yeah, watching him just knock all these movies out of the park, it's so exciting to see, because it's like, where is he going to go next? Like, how is he going to evolve next? How is he going to, you know, top himself next? Because that's really what he's been doing continuously.
I can't say anything I don't know from action movies or from kung fu movies whatsoever.
Well, it's interesting because he's well known for his writing. Did not realize he was as good of a director, so I need to check out this movie. It's one of those movies that, once again, I missed. I could have had a screener for it, but you know what? It'll pop up eventually. I'm pretty sure I can find it at Chinatown.
It's Patrick, going to be available somewhere.
Yeah, Patrick, I think you got about 10 minutes to sell us on your number one pick.
I don't even need 10 minutes to do that. You're either going to be, like this movie right off the bat, or you're not, not going to be interested whatsoever. But my favorite was a movie called Fritz Lang, which I kind of, just as soon as I saw the title, I had a feeling that I was really going to like this movie. But it ended up being way more interesting and way more beautiful and way more haunting than I even thought it was going to be. So it's basically, the plot is kind of weird. It's sort of fan fiction-y Fritz Lang's life, right? So it takes real details from his life and then also creates this kind of murder mystery that was also somewhat real but mostly fake. Like, his interactions with it have nothing to do with reality, history, I should say. So it takes place right after, he hasn't come up, right? So he's sort of searching for his next movie. He's sort of lazing around, philandering a little bit, doing his Fritz Lang stuff. Apparently he was noted for that. And, he's attending cocktail parties. He's just kind of bored, looking for his next movie idea. And these murders start happening in Dusseldorf in Germany. And this movie is in German with subtitles. He starts to investigate into it. He happens to know the police chief up there, and which it reveals he's had dealings with this guy in the past. So he looks into the case, and it's not so much about the mystery of who the killer is that he's there for, but why the killer kills. Because Fritz sees he's having his own sort of breakdown in a way, or he sees some of the darker sides of this serial killer in himself. And so he's trying to sort of find answers to his own, to questions about himself. And the movie goes a bit into his past, again, some of which is based on history. He did have a first wife whose death was a little bit of a mystery. That is true. And Fritz refused to talk about what happened, though there are some, books and other writings that think that he may have had a hand in it. Yes, I researched a ton of Fritz Lang after watching this movie. And so a lot of this stuff, like, he suppressed much information on his own past and, in fact, burned lots of documents before his death. Refused to talk about his past, essentially. He didn't want to talk about himself at all. But he, he did serve in World War I. His wife did have a mysterious death where she supposedly shot herself in the chest. And the woman that he was cheating on her with, who ended up being his next wife, they happened to be in the apartment at the time.
Ooh.
So it's a little weird.
Yeah, a little bit.
Anyway, so the movie takes this sort of darker elements that may be inside him and some of the guilt and killer behavior, and it shows some stuff from World War I as well, and has him tracking down this real-life serial killer who was the Demon of Dusseldorf or something like that. It was basically this real life. This also is true. There was a serial killer at the time that was killing women and children. And you see how his pursuit of this man and the answers that he's seeking as to why this man does what he does is forms the basis for M, A City Hunts for a Killer or a Murderer, which would be is one of Fritz Lang's greatest. It's possibly his greatest movie. It's definitely a masterpiece.
Oh, yeah.
So you sort of see how certain little things. This is the fan fiction part. Like, obviously, Fritz Lang did base M slightly on the Dusseldorf killer, but he also based him on a lot of other, or based the movie on a lot of other serial killers. But this, it's fascinating. It's just a fascinating look into how a creative person might think, investigating something like this, doing research, how they start to form scenes. So the movie cuts back and forth between what Fritz is seeing on this murder case investigation and then scenes from M as to how he may have, you know, gotten those ideas. And obviously it doesn't matter if this is how he really got those ideas. What is fascinating about it is seeing a creative mind like that, a dark creative mind. And Fritz Lang was definitely known as sort of a tyrant on the set and certainly one of the darker creative minds out there. He certainly made movies that dealt with the darker side of humanity. And this movie, Fritz Lang, does a really good job at portraying that. It's also shot in beautiful black and white photography. It's not quite as it's not quite shot in the same style as Fritz Lang's own movies, but it does use a lot of those same odd angles, the Dutch angles that we were talking about earlier from Laplace's Demon.
Sorry, I'm still just like mind blown that one of the greatest directors of all time, who made one of like the greatest films of all time, maybe killed his wife. Maybe he was the serial killer that M is based on.
Well, you know, it's funny, and that's the thing. That's sort of what the movie implies. There's a lot of like he's sort of figuring this out on his own. Like M was working out his own issues in many ways, in many respects. It's a fascinating movie. It is shot, like I say, black and white, but it's also in the 1.3 aspect ratio, which I love that they did that. I love that they went boxy and it gives you so much more room on the top of the frame to breathe in shots. It's very classically done. The lighting is not as stark as sort of the German expressionism back in the time, but it definitely does the job really well. It's a beautiful movie. A lot of smoking in this movie, which I love that they went with that. They just went all out with it. I could watch the actor playing Fritz Lang smoke a cigarette all day. He's fantastic. He also, by the way, is one of the most charismatic actors I have seen in a long time, and has a voice that I think I could just listen to speak German and not understand what he was saying forever. I wanted to kind of bathe in this movie, to tell you the truth, as a cinema lover. I wanted to see it again as soon as I finished it, but it was that good to me. If you have an interest in Fritz Lang and in the creation of old movies in general, like, this is definitely one to check out. It gets the time period right so well. The director does a great job with his low budget of saving money by showing old footage, newsreel footage of Germany in order to change locations. So it's like, oh, Fritz Lang needs to travel to Dusseldorf from wherever he's at. Okay, well, I'm going to show old train station footage, old people, you know, footage of people on trains. I'm going to show the police station from newsreel footage. He does a great job of setting the scene and making it, it does two things at once. It sets the scene perfectly. It allows for him to have filming all over, to have locations all over Germany. But it also contrasts this sort of happy, you know, oh, there's people always smiling and waving, and it looks like one of those old movies. People always seem very, very happy, with the dark, dark shit that's going on in this movie, because this killer is weird. He's got some interesting viewpoints that also sort of serve as a slight allegory for World War II and Nazism. Because Fritz, I don't know if you guys know about this about him as well, but he fled Germany because of, he's half Jewish. His mother was Jewish, so they considered him to be full Jewish, but they actually asked him to be the head of their whole film department. But he was not a Nazi sympathizer, and as soon as they asked him to do that, he politely declined, and he left the country the very next day and got out. He divorced his wife because she was a Nazi sympathizer. She was going that way, and he fled to America and ended up making movies here. He went back to Germany in like the 50s, apparently, but he saw that there were way too many ex-Nazis still running in the film industry there. So he came back to the US, and he was considered kind of a traitor, a cultural traitor in Germany up for a long, long time. And I think they finally had a festival dedicated to him, the first festival ever dedicated to one of the greatest filmmakers around the year 2000, somewhere in there. But they didn't really celebrate Fritz Lang for a long, long time in Germany. And again, this isn't a biopic in the sense that, you know, you're going to learn a lot about Fritz Lang's life. I did a lot of research into this, but it is a great, like, it's one of those weird, yes, this is based on a lot of reality, and yes, we are totally making all this up unabashedly. So it's got a little bit of that. It's a really fascinating movie, but I just love the whole atmosphere of everything. The actors, they all just nail it. Like, it's, and the director nails it as well. I definitely want to see it again.
Sounds worth checking out.
And sir, is this like an American film? Is it a German film?
It's a German film. It's in German with subtitles. Yeah. So, all right. So that is my pick. That's Fantasia in a nutshell. God, you guys saw so many more movies. So if anybody's interested in hearing about, like, or reading about all the other great and maybe not so great movies that were playing at Fantasia 2017, you gotta go to GoombaStop.com. Go to SordidCinema.com, where we've just got, I don't know, how many movies did we end up covering? 40, was it, Rick? Something around there?
Well, I still have two reviews that I'm going to publish as soon as we're finished this podcast. So I think we're up to about, like, I don't know, 50. Maybe more. So Sword of Cinema is the film section of GoombaStump.com, where you can find this podcast, and you can also find all of our Fantasia Film Festival coverage, of which we go to Fantasia each and every single year, so expect us to have triple that amount next year.
Yeah, because we're getting even more writers. Other than that, like, definitely just, yeah, go read up on all that stuff. Check out all the coverage that especially Thomas and Rick did. There's a lot of capsule reviews, a lot of full-on reviews. It's just, it's boatloads. Is there anything else we need to tell them about for Sordid Cinema, Rick?
We will be covering the Toronto International Film Festival in a few weeks. I cannot wait. Our buddy Edgar Chaput is going to be joining us, along with Victor Stiff, Simon Howell, myself, and God knows who else is going to... We'll most likely see a ton of people at the Toronto Film Festival, so I'm really excited for that. I think that's about it.
Yeah, it's a really good crew covering that. All right, so you can obviously find us online at Sordid Cinema. I run the Sordid Cinema Twitter account. And then, Rick, you are at Goomba Stomp Mag?
Goomba Stomp Mag on Twitter. You can also follow us on Facebook, Tumblr, Instagram, Pinterest, and you name it. And, check out our video game podcast, The N Express. And if you like Twin Peaks, do check out Simon's Twin Peaks podcast. Oh, and you know what? If you like the show, why not give us a rating on iTunes, please? We haven't really asked for ratings on iTunes. So we used to have like 60-plus ratings on iTunes on our old feed. But since we moved over to a new site, we no longer have that feed. Had to start a new feed. And we need to get more ratings. So if you listen to the podcast, even if you've given us a rating in the past, do us a favor and give us a new rating on our new feed, please.
Yeah, throw in a comment or two there, too. If you think that I hate everything, write that down. Apparently, that's some reputation that I've gotten. I do not hate movies. But anyway, Thomas, where can we find you online?
I'm on Twitter under Tom Types Words, exactly the way it sounds. No underscores, all one thing. You can find the page for my column on Sound On Sight, which is called Tom Watches Movies. Bit of a theme.
Sound On Sight. Yep. Sound On Sight, Tom.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Cinema, he means.
I'm sorry. I call him on Goomba Stomp. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you can find Tom Watches Movies on the Sordid Cinema page of GoombaStomp.com. And Tom does type words. I know, because I read every single one of them.
Yep. It's what I do with my time.
Bizarre as some of those words are, Tom, I read them all. All right, well, that should do it for today. We will see you next time.
Fuck, do you have a motherfucking swastika tattoo on your face?
Here we go.
Damn!
Amigos, bienvenidos al infierno.